Yes, I know.
But could we start by asking you how you ever got there? Because you were in adult education before, weren't you? Before
yes.
You went to Morley. Mm-hmm. What? How did you went to Morley in 1940? I think that's right, isn't it?
Yes. No. This is hopeless. Ian.
Anyway, how did you get there?
Collective.
Yes.
How? What made you take a job there?
Ian. Oh, he's gone out. Then he's gone out.
When did Michael go to Morley?
It doesn't matter.
Well, he'll tell him when
it's... We'll make a note of the odd things.
This is a minor matter. Yes.
So I'm going to put my washing machine on.
Not to worry.
Yes.
Not. No. I think I've got to put a bit of value into it. It was. I was living on a very minute amount of earnings in order that I could do a composition I wanted to do. And after I had ceased, I ceased teaching half-time doing some French and prep school. I then, somebody told me, I went into the adult education service, and it was partly mildly left-wing in a sense. It was the Royal Arsenal Corps. But this was children's choirs and choirs of this kind, and that means that I was, in fact, accredited, whatever that might have been to many adult education those at the time. But then it really came through my going to this strange, this very interesting story, in which Ian's got a great deal of material. It's interesting in quite a different way. There was David knows all about it, but David was then on The Guardian, and there was some. But and up in the north, and that was this is 1932-3, mm-hmm. And that was oh dear, this is.
Oh, you left a Hazelwood, didn't you? And then
yes,
you went
now
into
this is a special thing that took place in a work camp in the Cleveland Ironstone Miners. I think we'll leave Ian to tell you. Well, Ian's got it all down in documentation.
Not to worry, yes.
But in one of the people on this work camp. I went up to do some, as it were, music. It came from a strange figure called Rolf Gardner. David came over from Manchester, and it was took place on the ironstone miners in Cleveland Hills. Mm-hmm. One of the people who David had known as a child and had grown up together, Alan Coleridge, was on the same camp, and Alan was at. It was then very keen. I don't know how he got to know Eva Hubbard, but he knew her very well. It was
he
a constant.
Knew everybody. He
knew
everybody. Was one of those people.
Yes.
So did Eva, actually.
Yes. Well, he.
So
they were. They were at that moment trying to make it possible for Morley, and in its status as a non-vocational training or college, and all the rest of it, to have some special classes for unemployed, which would be daytime. And so the music, they did seem to Alan Coleridge, I don't think to Eva, but to Alan, as far as I could understand, that the unemployment in professional theatre musicians mainly, and young people, was important issue, and that it would be possible, therefore, to have an orchestra which would keep them in training. And therefore, I was asked to do this. So I went into Morley College in as a daytime teacher, not on the staff of Morley at all, I should say in about 1933-4.
I see. Mm.
That was the time of the South London
Orchestra. We produced an orchestra called the South London Orchestra. It's a long history and a very interesting one indeed, in its own way. Mm. And I was paid for, at the rates of adult education lecturers, 16 shillings an hour, whatever it was, and did a 2-hour stint once a week. And we built it up to quite a considerable thing. And I got to know Eva through at that time because...
Because she was principal
yes, she
all
was
through
principal
that
all
period.
Through that period.
Yes.
I found her a remarkable woman. And then when the war came, of course, the orchestra disbanded, everything was disbanded. And that was that for about 18 months, whatever it was, until the college was destroyed. It was so.
Yeah.
But the man who ran the music at the college, whose name's gone out of my head, I don't remember. He was also teacher in Westminster School, I think. And they were evacuated, and he went out with the school, and therefore gave when the college was destroyed, landmine, he decided that he couldn't go on anymore. There was nothing much to go on with. And she asked, Eva then came to me quite independently afterwards, and would I like to begin again with all that was left, I beg your pardon, of the actual personnel of the choir, which was about 12 people, and that the actual operational work was, as you know, the small portion of the college still standing, the Holstrom, and the library above, which gave the administrative offices, cultural, told you all about that. But things like the activities of the choir at that time, until the rubble was cleared away and so forth, was done in a primary school or secondary school just across the road somewhere, in a classroom. And so I then found myself, again, only earning there was no method of earning beyond the conditions of teaching.
Sort of thing.
What they did normally, once we built up, slowly I did, with her help stimulation, quite a considerable group of people. But I didn't want to teach, I delegated, and the only way which you could earn proper money was to do it all yourself. And during that period, you see, I got very attached to her indeed, and found this, what did I say, the characteristic which most moved me was the warmth of character, the liberal qualities. I wasn't aware for some time she was Jewish, but I did in the end, of course, not that it made any difference at all. But I suddenly began to realise more who she was, and she used to tell me a lot about how it had come about, how Morley had come about, how the whole tradition of women principals and so forth, and then I was occasionally went into the home. And then she was very good to me, obviously, in fact, we got very close. I mean, I think we're the only person of my age and that called her by her Christian name, and we knew her, and it was on those sort of easy, reasonable terms. And then, of course, I had to go to prison, and she was, it wasn't at all a pacifist in the country, object in any sense, but she was, it always intrigues me that she was, when the conditions of alternative service had something ridiculous to her, because it really did appear that if I would agree to go and do very much what I was doing in Morley College in an air raid warden's place across the other side of the road, I would be okay. I would have been under condition of service, and even she felt very, this was extremely stupid and silly. And so she was very nice about it all, and I came back when I came, I don't know who took over when I was there, I was only away a short time, and most of it was the vacation period. And I went on with her, growing more attached to her altogether, because then, of course, I was in the position of looking after the music and was slowly making the music, quite obviously, in the end, as equal as it had been with Holst. And it was a remarkable period, there's no question. And again, there's much more about what was done, because we went out into, there's not a lot of music in London, we produced a great deal of extremely interesting music indeed. But I got increasingly disturbed by it, and she was tried very hard to make it possible for me to get some sort of salary independent of merely the teaching the choir in the week. I think I got up to a grand sum of £120 a year or something ridiculous, which was not, even then, was not very much, put it that way. And I did other outside work. But she managed to make it so that I could take the whole summer term off without disturbing what was being built up, that there was enough good people there. She agreed with me that we could use, if they were willing to work on these terms, really first-class people. We had, so that Sandy Gurr's father, Walter Gurr, conducted the orchestra, and Matthias Scheiber, who was a marvellous teacher, he was killed. Amongst younger people who I drew in for instrumental playing of the concerts were mostly a peculiar lot. They were medical rejects, obviously, there were Don Amos was one and Danny Hopkins. But then there were also figures like the three senior members of the Amadeus Quartet who were young men. Yes, they weren't allowed to fight. David knows all about this because he was one of them, he was taught. So they were in factories, and she was very good about.
There were double nationality cases.
Yes,
there?
I don't. Yes,
German nationality.
Yes, really? Yes, mm-hmm. And that's not the cello who married one of the other one married a girl who was in the same class. Well, these they came and played, but we would get them out of. She did a great deal to keep Norbert Brynjen from getting manual work, which would destroy his hands. But in fact, the quartet was almost begun at that period. They came together, began to be interested, in which I sort of persuaded them to move. It was an interesting period. Then I got to the point when I felt somehow it was. And I was having to move away. Then she died. She died in
about 1950.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I felt very strongly for some reason. It was the end for me too. I didn't really take to to her successor. But I, odd enough, had a funny feeling. I didn't like the breaking of the traditional woman principle. It was very odd. I mean, it's partly, I suppose. I don't know. I just felt that she was a remarkable woman. I think they tried very hard to find one, but they didn't. So then at 51 I came out altogether, and of course and that was the end of that.
So actually your leaving Morley was due to her death to some extent?
No, it was a mixture.
It would have happened anyhow,
but had she gone on alive and wanted me to go on a bit longer, I might have done so. But her death, I mean, I had no means of earning much, and I had a difficult time, but I nevertheless wanted to come out in order to give more time entirely to composition, and also I'd done the job.
Yes, quite. I mean, if I may say, you're answering all the questions I wanted answered without my asking questions, because I mean, you're excellent. Could I just go back to the very beginning? I mean, the Morley College does have a great musical tradition, as you say. Why, really?
That's quite interesting. It was due to the odd figure, or interesting figure, that Holst was, who was a mixture of a teacher and a composer, and his teaching was very real to him. Now, how he ever got into Morley, I don't know, but he got in under the terms in which he was going to do teaching there, especially choir training. And he had a strong sense that his ideas about amateur music were very strong indeed, as his generation was, as Vaughan Williams and all of them. He nevertheless had a strong sense of kind of music that could be done, and also the kind of standards which could really be raised. But he never wanted to forego the principle that moral principle that anybody who wanted to sing could join the choir. Now he came up against the problem. I don't know who he was with. I suppose it's not Eva. It's somebody earlier.
Well, it might. Well,
Rathbone.
Eva's predecessor was Lady Wharton, Baroness Wharton.
Oh yes, that's right.
And she left about 1927. But I don't know who preceded her. I ought to know.
Yes,
oh, Mary Sheepshanks. I'm not quite sure.
The issue was a reasonably interesting one. Is that he wasn't under the terms of the college. He really hadn't got the means of he couldn't discard people.
I see.
But he introduced a principle, I mean, this is how it's put, I don't know how accurate it is, that by the material which he wanted to get them to sing, he would sort it out. Mm. And by his extraordinary drive, you see, he produced a very remarkable body of singers and then he, in his own individual way, tended to join them. He produced things outside the college, from within. He went to his Much Hadamore Hadley, wherever he lived, and he would take some of the choir out on a famous set of outings
Central.
No, the one that comes after Easter. Whitson.
Yes,
they used to have these. It was either Easter or Whitson. They would go on their sort of pilgrimages,
yes,
and do music. And this, to what I can't answer, and I don't know, I must ask Ian when he comes back. We might tell me. I've no idea really what it amounted to, but it had become a considerable tradition.
Mm. And this is a choral tradition primarily, is it?
It was a choral tradition. Mm. Again, I can't answer you with whether it went into an orchestra. I had once produced an orchestra as well.
Mm.
But then, well, he must have had composition classes, yes. Mm. Choral. And he may have had a madrigal choir as well as a bigger choir, like I did, I suppose. I don't remember this. Whether he had instrumental, I can't quite answer you that.
Because if one looks at Morley, I mean, it has a number of advantages. I mean, I agree Holst is a very distinguished figure in himself, but it also has a terrific catchment area, doesn't it? Lots of concerts going on in that area. So that it's a good, in a way...
Well, all I know now is what Eva herself told me. And she said that originally, in the original notion of it, was to have been more of a residential college like Toynbee Hall and Marywold Settlement, perhaps, but that it was placed in this position where there wasn't a residential area in those terms, so that from the first go, she said, they found themselves drawing a catchment area chiefly at the start out of Whitehall.
Yeah.
And that this meant that people coming out of Whitehall offices and drew that kind of, what is it, people who open university people, if you like, to use our modern terms, and that therefore this gave them that liberal extension. I can't make a real proper comparison with what went on at Toynbee, I have no idea.
No, but
it's an entirely different setup.
Yes, that's the point, I think.
In a way, Morley is closer to the City Literary Institute.
Yes, I mean, it's very much for Londoners, and not slum patronage.
No, it was meant to be and was not.
Mm.
Mind you, it must have been odd, because she seemed to have been, perhaps she was as a younger woman, or she seemed to have been in and out of the days when it was still in the old Vic itself, but she may have been telling me the history without being anything more.
You see, when you actually got there, there's already a lot there. I mean, it's not as though you had to create things from the start.
No, the great tradition was there. Mm. I beg your pardon, of course it was.
No, I wasn't suggesting you'd said any other, but it's just that I wondered quite what you had there to start with. In a way, you had a lot, but in a way, you had a little.
You had a tradition, but had nothing.
Yes, quite, yes.
No, it was a mechanics, in a sense. There was all of us left was the rump of a choir. I don't know what else there had been. I mean, I suppose there was no physical conditions, because there were no... Everything that in the library had been blown up. There was rubble, but it hadn't been disentangled. So the music library had gone, such as they had it. I beg your pardon, the music library had gone. The main library remained, which was on top of the Holst room. And the Holst room was virtually all that there was there till they put up some sort of various shacks, places. So that, and I don't think they meant necessarily Eva thought that the music was the first thing to put back. She obviously put back as soon as she could get Eden or whatever classes were going on. I don't know quite the answer to that. But the assignment to me was of course a more, probably more wider and more complicated, because you had to, not only find the personnel, you see, but
decide what to do.
Decide what to do. So
this is your, let's be clear, you are now talking about the second period of Morley.
Yes, not when I'm with the Royal, that's after the war.
Talking about 1940.
And I'm really with, under her.
Yes.
In the earlier time, I really wasn't under her. I didn't see her in that way.
You were sort of extension lecturer in a way, were you? I mean,
you
were far flung more.
The old building was still, the old building was there, and we used the main drill hall on the stage off.
Mm.
And she got drawn into it because I started doing things which were beyond the assignment. Quite remarkable. She agreed to let me have Sunday evening concerts done by this very odd body, and I've just tried to raising money for them, which is all an odd idea, and I've persuaded quite a number of distinguished pianists mostly to come and play with the orchestra for nothing. You got in, it was, I suppose, a mixture of the old tradition of the poor and the slums or whatever you like. You could get into this concert for a shilling. And whatever the number of shillings, it never amounted to very much. It was distributed in an orchestra, a few pounds, in point of fact, it came. There was one extraordinary man, Cockrell can remember it probably very well. It was really very fantastic. Because one of the pianists was Myra Hess. And somehow or other it got around that she was there, and you could hear of her this way. And the college got besieged. And Myra was up in the funny sort of turret room, that's where it used to be, which was besieged. It was an old drill hall where we were waiting in a room about eighth the size of this little town room where we were just waiting. And I was in evening dress, so was she, and I was in tails, in fact. And Cottrell came up in a terrible state of affairs. He said, "I don't know what to do." He said, I daren't fetch the police, there's going to be a rot, I don't know what to do. We're now far more people than the building should legally have of every kind, and they simply can't get any more into the hall. They're sitting on the platform, and I said, "Well, leave it to me." So I went out. And addressed this multitude and said, "Now, you can't get into the hall, it's already packed with people, but if you sit on the floor, open all the doors, and be quiet, you'll probably hear the music, and will you please behave yourselves properly?" And went off again. Cottrell by this time said, "Want to call the police, you see, and have them all turned out." And I said, "I'm so silly. Wait till the police come, in any case." And then, I mean, Eva would have been on my side if she was there on the occasion. I went back to Barra and said, "Well, I'm very sorry, it will be very odd, because you will find people virtually sitting on the seat beside you on as you play the piano." She came down and she was so moved, she was absolutely in tears. She was so moved, this warmth of sort of humanity that came to her. It was a bloody bad performance, I should think, probably. But
was this just after her Jesus Joy recording? I mean, that was made a great impact at the time.
I'd have to ask Ian that technical question. Yes. I can't answer
she was
beloved by everybody.
I mean, it was a symbolic thing in a way.
It was a symbolic thing, and none of the others didn't do it. And that, of course, they all had to. I think, don't know who collected the shillings. I think Cottrell had given it up. But he was very good too, you know, because he would give his time, you see, to come on a Sunday extra.
Yes.
Do this. We didn't have them quite very, very often. And they were not very distinguished concerts and at all. I mean, with the South London Orchestra.
They were mainly unemployed.
They were
the
unemployed.
Talkies weren't there.
Yes, they were. They were
in the cinema.
They were a very odd lot. Mm-hmm. One or two quite young who hadn't a job at all. Mostly they were theatre people. And they really were an odd collection. And I didn't do what they wanted. I mean, I wasn't ever born that way. I just did what I wanted. So that they had to play the most extraordinary things just for me to have fun, to learn the pieces. They wanted large-scale works of Glazunov. I went to the publishers, all the publishers, and said, you will just please hand music over for nothing. But I will promise to give you back the material if you need the material on hand. And they were always, everybody was very good. In fact, my own publishers I met in this way because which is really quite ridiculous. I heard the first performance in England, and it must have been about 34, or even earlier, quite very early on with Henry Woodworth, of the Stravinsky Violin Concerto with Dushkin. Mm. I was fascinated with this extraordinary piece, and went off to Chart London long before I ever became with them at all, and made them hand over the material, and they said, "Well, we'd give it back." They said nobody wanted to play it, and somebody found a girl fiddler who was about to learn this thing, because the men thought this was the end of the world, because they didn't give them anything to play, because they just wanted to. So there was always some division in that orchestra between what I was up to and what they really wanted.
But somehow there's a match.
Yes. Well, we got into a bargaining thing, and they liked the day out and whatever it was. We did an afternoon. When it came to the real thing inside Morley, then of course it was for real.
Yes.
I followed on Hell's tradition of making the material of what we were going to do the reason for the choice of people coming. You had to be prepared to want to do the things that we were saying, which was Madrigals, Monteverdi, and they were a very, very good group. It became an extremely good choir.
The Monteverdi was very early.
Yes, this is all... Well, this is... It's... I beg your pardon. This begins in about 1940 or 41, whatever it is, but it didn't come to its flowering after the war.
No. Your point is that, you wouldn't even have gramophone records of Monteverdi at that stage, would you?
A famous set of records had come out just before or just after. This was Nadia Boulanger who produced a remarkable set of records. They absolutely fascinated us all, absolutely. Mm.
Still, this is all quite avant-garde stuff by the standards
of
the time.
Well, you see, then by that time I'd drawn in Walter Gurr to do the conducting. And he was high powered, he wanted a lot of money, but he was, some other side to him, was willing to do this. He did the concerts I did most training. And then one of his pals was a Monteverdi scholar, old Radlich, who was Oxford at that time, I think. And it was through, you see, Radlich that Gurr said, now with this choir, you'll train it and we'll get an orchestra. We would like to, we gave professional concerts outside the college. Mm. See, because there's no hall in the college anyhow. I mean, you have backed all this. And we performed this extraordinary performance, virtually the first world performance of Monteverdi Vespers.
Really?
Yes. Mm. Which was done, I don't know, 47, 46, 47. Mm. Extraordinary occasion. Nobody knew we got over that it was a world beater. But,
Now everybody, it was a very well-known work.
Very,
it's
very
well-known think that it
work,
wasn't.
Yes, it was. And then we did one at, we did a very early performance for the BBC, in fact, of Les Noces, which had been another Donkey's Years, and again, there wasn't a professional musical life there is now. The war ceased, but it hadn't come back into existence, and we really did a hell of a lot. Mind you, another thing, in 51, you see, the Festival Hall is there, and through Sarah Schemings, I think, Morley Music was asked to do 2-3 concerts, I don't remember. And again, this seemed a natural end.
Yes.
In a very good condition. It's quite clear that the music making that we had done was quite real and meant for its time, but it was going to mean very little, but it was going to be quite different once the professional music world began again.
Yes, South London in a way is taking off by 1951, yes.
And also Morley, whoever had been there after that would have gone back into what it was.
Could I ask you, were you consciously trying to emphasise English music? Host Elgar,
that type of thing?
What?
Oh, that's another intriguing story. Because, I was in one of the stories, is simply that in sorting through the rubble of the music library, I came across a few volumes, the Purcell Society, the old Purcell Society, huge edition, folio edition, and ran off with them, stole them, because nobody seemed to want them and can. I don't know whether I told you about this or not, but this was my first entry into Purcell. My real believer saw what Purcell was. I got fascinated. And so I start, then from that comes my intention of doing the big Purcell St. Cecilia's Day ode and my accident I got after. Not long after I came out of prison, I had to go to Canterbury Cathedral for a piece of my own, and then I heard Delos. He's and we brought him up to do this. Mm. However, out of this came my predecessor, Arnold Foster. Whether he's alive or not, I don't know, but he got very agitated. Whether he was just professional jealousy or whatever, he got round Vaughan Williams. I wasn't even told me it's not till some long time after, and persuaded Vaughan Williams to write to Eva Hubbock and complain of the fact that Morley was become international and not national, and that people like Gurr was teaching and Scheiber, and even the Amadeus Quartet were playing these people. And he said, and Eva told me afterwards, she wrote a letter back that was extant, and she said, I appreciate your position, but I think you should be very pleased that people of what you feel are, I didn't say an inferior group, are being under Michael's direction or playing Purcell.
Yes.
Oh, yes. You would never catch her. I mean, she was a lovely person.
I think, you know, it must... it's odd, looking back to those wartime concerts in Morley. Mm.
Yes, of course you remember.
Yes, I remember very clearly. I can't... I don't believe you can, because we both have very partial eyesight on these things, but I think I'm right in saying that there must have been a good deal of general feeling that you oughtn't to have enemy musicians, and so on.
I think it came...
You think it came later?
No, it came from... Vaughan Williams was the tradition was this in very, oh, yes, very strong nationalist tradition.
Yes.
Nationalist,
no, I was thinking not on that side, but tied up with...
I don't know. It might have been. I didn't care a damn, so I couldn't answer that. I think it might have been. I agree with you. I think it might have been. Oh, I think so. I think so. And I think somebody got at volumes in this way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was tried to point it out that in a way it may have been true. You see, Holst was the same tradition as Vaughan Williams, and it might well have been that they were fighting for what they felt was some sort of new world in English music, and they had this very strongly. So it's possible that, I mean, this is another part of quite different thing. Vaughan Williams he disliked both myself and Britain quite a lot over this issue. We grew to, later
he
on, I went on his trust, I became
gave,
very
gave
very
evidence close. For you at your tribunal.
Yes, he'd always do that. He was so upright a person, but he didn't. He thought that we had betrayed his traditions, and Britain. He never even met Britain. He was so strong.
Really?
With me, we all got on, and when he, I always believed that when he wanted another composer on his trust, as himself, he went to the person he thought would be absolutely upright as I was. I didn't have any nonsense about anything. But at the same time was absolutely hostile to his own views.
Really, yes. It's interesting.
And it's very, very Vaughan Williams.
So, if I could ask you...
So my answer is I was always an internationalist.
Yes, quite,
well.
Yes. And in a way...
Not politically, I'm there because...
No, but I mean, there's a strong case for being an internationalist in that situation anyway, isn't there? I mean, just musically, but generally.
Yeah, yeah.
Looking back over your whole period then at Morley, from, say, 40 to 51... Because I looked up Who's Who, you see, before I came, and Who's Who says Director of Music at Morley College, 1940 to 51. But in fact, it was a post that sort of grew.
It wasn't Director of Music.
Yes, I mean, one main thing that you do then is to internationalise the whole setup.
It came really, in some of it was practical.
Mm.
Part of first of all, dealing with the teachers, well, a lot of them weren't there, and I knew these people through an accident, and I wanted the very best. Well, both Gurr and Scheiber was Hungarian, Gurr was German, and they were not involved in army affairs in any case, so they were on hand, and I knew them personally. That's one side of it. With the younger people, it was a matter of getting really young players who would want to do a lot of English stuff, Gibbons and all sorts of stuff, and Purcell and Bach and anybody, you see, of this Renaissance period chiefly, and a little earlier. And they were drawn from member to member. How they came, I cannot remember. But obviously, you couldn't, if they were either still students and not reaching military age, you see, or else they were, as I said, they were medical rejects, or these strange characters whom I, however, met the Amadeus.